FBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. The Visalia Ransacker. The East Area Rapist. The Original Night Stalker. The Golden State Killer. These are all monikers attributed to one man. A man who terrorized the state of California for over a decade and then seemed to disappear. Joseph DeAngelo stalked, raped, and murdered both men and women from 1973 through 1986. And then he went about living his life. Until one spring morning in 2018, when Sacramento County Sheriff's deputies showed up at his house and arrested him. 32 years had passed by since DeAngelo's last known attack. I can only imagine the surprise and shock that he must have felt when the police showed up at his doorstep. How could they possibly have caught him all these years later? The answer is Paul Holes. Paul continued to work on the case to the point of obsession for years. He was determined to identify this mystery attacker and to bring him to justice. And on August 21st of this year, Joseph DeAngelo finally answered for his heinous crimes. He pled guilty to 13 counts of murder and 13 counts of kidnapping in order to avoid the death penalty. He was sentenced to multiple consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. The reality is, Joseph DeAngelo will die in prison. And here with me today is the man responsible for this new reality. One of the hosts of the Murder Squad podcast, the one and only Paul Holes. This is Season 9, Episode 15, The Case of the Golden State Killer.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that he did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, Paul, thank you so much for joining me. It looks like where you're at in Colorado, it's sunny, it looks like, in the background.
Yeah, well, you know, right now it's mid-afternoon and it's cloudy and it is down in the teens in terms of the temperatures.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, we were talking off the air. You're in Colorado Springs. I went to college in Boulder, and you haven't been. You need to make that trip. They say they have 360 sunny days a year in Boulder.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, I definitely plan on getting up there, just haven't had the opportunity to yet.
Nice. And so getting into your background a little bit, most of my audience knows kind of your professional background. We will touch on that. But you mentioned, so right after you retired from work out in California, you moved to Colorado. Or how did you end up there? Do you have roots in Colorado? How did you end up there?
I have no roots whatsoever. You know, this literally was, you know, as I was aging in my career, getting towards the end, you know, conversations with the family was like, we're going to move out of the Bay Area and move out of California. It just where? And, you know, thought we might end up in the Pacific Northwest because we had been up there. Absolutely beautiful. Just stunning up there. But then we binge watched a Netflix show called The Killing, which was about this female homicide detective out of Seattle.
I know exactly the one you're talking about.
Yeah. And in every single episode, it is pouring rain. And my wife turned to me and said, nope, we're not moving there. But where we were living in California was Vacaville. And I actually ended up in Vacaville because my dad was in the Air Force and was stationed at Travis Air Force Base for part of his career. And so it's a military town. And so my wife had talked to some of the military wives that were part of the mommy network with the kids at school. And, you know, of course, they had lived in a variety of places being military. Mm-hmm. And a fair number of them said, you know, if we were to move back to some place where we had been before, it'd be Colorado Springs. And that's what we did, is we ended up researching Colorado Springs online, flew out, did a, you know, kind of quick tour of it and said, yeah, this is nice, you know, and at least to get, I have a younger set of kids that are just now, what, the oldest is starting high school. And we thought, well, we'll get the kids at least through high school here. So that's what we did. Mm-hmm. I retired. You know, was not expecting my life to change as dramatically as it did. But right after we retired, we got out here, bought a house, and I was literally out here buying a house when I got notified about the DNA matching D'Angelo on the Golden State Killer case.
That's crazy. I'm going to have my wife not listen to this episode because I made the mistake of taking her out to visit Colorado with me a few years ago on a vacation, and she's been telling me ever since that we're moving there. And I've been telling her, maybe we should finish working before we do that.
Yeah. Where are you at?
I'm in Southwest Michigan.
Oh.
Which is not exactly picturesque compared to Colorado. So that's why she loved being up in the mountains and everything when we were there. So she wants to go pretty bad. And I'm trying to keep pushing that back a few. Because I have kids about the same age. My oldest stepson just graduated high school, and my oldest boy is a sophomore right now.
Okay. All right.
And so the first really serious question for you is, how do you have your oldest kid just now going into high school and you're retired? And a follow-up question, what am I doing wrong?
Well, that's my oldest kid that is still in the house. I actually have two older kids from my first marriage. And so my oldest is 27. She's married. I have a granddaughter. And then I've got my oldest son, who is 24, living in Wisconsin with my ex.
Oh, gotcha. So you've kind of had this similar to me, a nice start over after a few years.
That's exactly it. You know, it was like, you know, when my first set of kids finally got out of diapers, you know, certain things in the personal life didn't go as well as planned. And then I got remarried, and then I ended up having right away, you know, more kids. And so I was dealing with babies and diapers again. It was like I was dealing with diapers for 15 years straight, it seemed like.
That sounds terrible. So how old is your youngest?
She is now 13.
13.
Yeah.
I've got a 9 still in the house. I have a 9 and a 15 and a 16-year-old.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah,
you're so busy. If any more diapers come to the Ruff household, I'm moving out because I'm done.
Yeah, no. I'm definitely done on that front.
Yeah. So getting into your career a little bit, as I said, most anybody that knows anything about true crime knows who Paul Holes is. But for anybody who doesn't, what was your background? You mentioned, and I want to get into a little bit too after this, that your career, your life took a turn that you probably weren't expecting.
Right.
But leading up to that, what did you do in law enforcement?
Well, you know, I became fascinated with forensics and actually forensic pathology because of an old TV show, you know, Quincy. You may remember mm-hmm. that with Jack Klugman.
Sure. Yep. Yeah.
And so I ended up going to college, and I was in a pre-med course, biochemistry, with the expectation of going to medical school. And, you know, my studies were not the best. I ended up goofing off a little bit, and you know, my grades weren't up there to get me into med school. So then it was, well, what am I going to do if I'm not going to go to med school? And then I just happened to luck into finding out about a field called criminalistics. And mm-hmm. that was at a job fair at UC Davis, where I went to college. I explored that. And then ultimately, the first career position that I got was as a forensic scientist. It was a forensic toxicologist with the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Crime Lab back in 1990.
Okay.
And so as a civilian forensic toxicologist, I'm doing dope analysis. I'm doing alcohol analysis, you know, testifying to alcohol impairment. You know, I'm spending a ton of time in court getting very comfortable testifying. But I always had my eye on the position that was kind of across town from where I was working, the deputy sheriff criminalist position. And that my sheriff's office was the very last law enforcement agency in California that required their criminalists to be sworn officers, which at the time I didn't have any desire to become a sworn officer. I was just interested in working homicides and going to crime scenes. But, you know, I bit the bullet. I went to the academy and got the position as a deputy sheriff criminalist, and I was assigned to crime scene investigation in the old serology unit where we're doing the ABO blood testing, enzyme testing. And so I kind of, started my forensics career in violent crimes doing this older technology. But we were getting the very first DNA typing technology on board in the lab.
So what year was that? Because that was early 90s.
This is 1994.
So that was right kind of when DNA was, you know, the OJ case had kind of introduced DNA to the country.
Exactly. In fact, you know, this was predating OJ just by a little bit. But as I'm training in DNA, you know, the OJ Simpson case, the trial is on the TV. And so I'm watching some of the notable DNA experts in the field at the time, such as Dr. Robin Cotton, you know, from Cellmark, et cetera, testifying. But right off the bat, even though I was where I wanted to be, I just became fascinated with serial predators because I read, my parents gave me a book for my birthday called Sexual Homicide, you know, and that's the one that the Netflix Mindhunter is based off of, the study that they did interviewing all these serial predators. So I became fascinated with serial predators and cold cases. And literally the first cold case that I started working on more as a hobby than anything was a case called the East Area Rapist case.
Right. He was East Area Rapist before he was the original Night Stalker.
Right.
And then then the connection was made between the two and he became the Erons.
Yes.
And then later the Golden State Killer.
Yes. And I can be blamed kind of for that connection because I was the one with what I did from the DNA side and basically a kind of a telephonic investigation. I was the one that linked the East Area Rapist cases from Northern California to the original Night Stalker homicides in Southern California. And quite frankly, I thought, well, that is going to be my contribution to that series. Basically, I've done what probably is all I'm going to do on that case.
Right. And so in what year was that when you made that connection?
That connection, I initially did the investigation in 1997. And landed with Mary Hong at the Orange County Sheriff's Office, but we had two different DNA technologies. It took 4 years for us to get on the same page. And at that point, I had promoted up to a lieutenant level position within the sheriff's office. And so I assigned, you know, the case out to a DNA analyst and then ultimately had him call Mary down there at Orange County. And they're literally reading the DNA profile to each other on the phone. And it was at that point in March of 2001 when the East Area Rapist was identified as being the same offender as the original Night Stalker. We just still didn't know who he was.
Right. But that's when you started linking things together. So a couple more questions about you, and then we're going to get into the case. And I want to talk about all that, the process where we went from right there.
Yep.
So you build your way up through the ranks. It was through the sheriff's department, right?
With sheriff's office, yes.
Yep, the sheriff's office. And then you end up retiring just, 2 days before Joe DeAngelo is finally arrested? Or before you get the DNA match?
I had a little bit of a sidestep in there from, you know, I did 24 years with the sheriff's office, and I rose up to a division commander within the sheriff's office. So I oversaw all of Forensic Services Division. I was a captain-level position. And then I, because of sort of this niche that I had made for myself in the county as the cold case person. The former elected DA was interested in running cold cases out of the DA's office. And of course, he and I knew each other, and he created a position for me. So I lateraled over for the last roughly 4 years of my career into the DA's office, to where now I am officially a cold case investigator, as well as sort of a forensic consultant to the prosecutors in the county.
Right. And then, so, and that was the position that your retirement came.
Right.
Just days before the identification was made.
Yeah. You know, well, my retirement, and I'm sure we'll get into the story. You know, I retired at the end of March, and D'Angelo was arrested April 24th. So we still had about 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks after I retired until he's taken into custody.
Right. Okay. So right after that, back to you personally, your career took a weird shift and you became, you know, we run in the same circles, Paul, and I've been around you at CrimeCon several times, and I could never get close to you because of the group of women that are following you around. So you've now become the rock star of the true crime space. So how did that happen?
You know, it's to this day, it's still surreal. And I think it was just the timing of everything couldn't have worked out better for me from the media opportunity side. Because when you think about 2018 on the Golden State Killer case, there was a local magazine, Diablo Magazine, did a big spread on me and my investigation into the East Area Rapist case. And there's a photograph of me on the cover of that magazine that ended up kind of being available online. And then two shows on this unsolved Golden State Killer case that I participated in aired in March of 2018. One was on HLN and one was on Discovery ID. Michelle McNamara's book also came out at this time frame, in which my name was in there a fair amount. Mm-hmm. So in February and March of 2018, all of a sudden, you've got this huge population of people who are learning, maybe for the first time, about the Golden State Killer case, either through TV or reading a book or seeing the magazine article. And then we solve the case within weeks of me retiring in April of 2018. Mm-hmm. And so now there is all this attention, you know, on me, because my name was in Michelle's book. I was in these shows and I had a role in helping solve the case. And it just took off from there, you know, and I was on the road, and I can't complain about anything that happened, but it was, you know, 2 years, it was very draining. And I know you and I were talking a little bit off camera, and you've had, you know, a similar experience on the media side, where it is a rigorous schedule. And, you know, that's where, you know, for those 2 years after I retired, I never got any downtime, you know, and I, because of the case and what was going on within the DA's office and my responsibilities, I had last taken a vacation about like a year and a half prior to me retiring. So really for 3.5 years, I never had any downtime up until this pandemic hit. And then,
right,
you know, then I got a break. And unfortunately, it's because of the pandemic, but it also was somewhat of a lifesaver in terms of I started to get my feet underneath me again and start doing the things that I thought I'd be doing when I retired, such as, you know, taking my Jeep out behind the mountains or mountain bike riding and stuff. So
sure, right. Yes, because I've come across you on several different TV shows, documentaries, 2020. You had your show on that. What was the name of your show on, not on Netflix, on Oxygen? What was the name of your show on Oxygen?
It was the DNA of Murder with Paul Holes.
Right. Yep. So there was the DNA of Murder. And then you have your podcast, which you do every week with Billy Jensen.
The Murder Squad.
Jensen Holes, the Murder Squad. So enough to keep you busy. It's just interesting that you made the shift from law enforcement to media mogul. And on that front is my last serious question before we get into the case. So yesterday I interviewed David Ridgen, who's the host of the Someone Knows Something podcast.
Okay.
And in order to set that up, he had a person that I had to call and talk to and make all the scheduling arrangements. And then today I'm talking to you, and to set this up, I had to, you have a person that I called and talked to schedule this meeting. So my question to you is why don't I have a person?
I do not have a person. You went through Polly, who's the producer for Murder Squad. So she is okay. Definitely, I am not in the realm of having a personal assistant by any stretch, though there are times, because I'm not necessarily somebody who's really good at staying on top of my schedule. I could use somebody who tells me, hey, you need to make this phone call or you need to show up here. Right. I mean, it would be nice to have an assistant to help out with a lot of the stuff. But, you know, one of these days, Bob, you'll get there. You'll have your own person.
Well, what pisses me off right now is I have the same person you do. I have Mike, my producer. You think he'd schedule an interview for me? No. He's just over there clickety-clacking, editing away.
You better get on him then.
Right. All right, Paul, so you played a massive role, integral role in the identification and capture of Joseph DeAngelo, who was known as many things, the Golden State Killer, the East Area Rapist, the original Night Stalker. And I know what everybody really wants to get into, and what I want to hear about is kind of your involvement and how that process went beyond what we just spoke about in our introduction. But first, can you just give us just a real basic breakdown? You know, he had a reign of terror, what, about 10 years from 1976 to 1986?
Yeah, well, it turns out he predates that by a couple of years. He's also the Visalia ransacker. So starting down in Visalia in 1974, they were having a series of fetishbergs. This guy's breaking into residence. You know, going into the women's underwear drawers, doing weird things inside the houses. And then ultimately he tries to abduct a 16-year-old girl out of her bed at night. And then her dad, Claude Snelling, tries to come to her rescue. And the ransacker drops the daughter and pulls a gun and shoots and kills Claude Snelling. He continues to commit these fetishbergs, and then he gets confronted by an officer, Visalia PD officer, Officer McGowan, and he actually shoots Officer McGowan. It's just that the bullet hits McGowan's flashlight, but the ransacker escapes and disappears. And that's at the end of December of 75. 6 months later, Sacramento, in the East Area Sacramento, in this Rancho Cordova neighborhood, we get our first East Area Rapist attack in June of 76. And this is where now we have an offender that is breaking into houses in the middle of the night. For the first 15 attacks, he's only attacking at houses where there's no men present.
Mm-hmm.
But on the 16th attack, he now breaks into a house where you have a couple sleeping in the bed. And he ends up making the woman tie up the male on the bed. He stacks dishes on the back of the male's. On the male's back as an alarm system, and then takes the woman into the family room where he sexually assaults her. And that becomes part of his ongoing MO, where from that point on, 2/3 of his attacks have male present. And this is something that's unusual about this offender as the East Area Rapist, is that he is purposefully choosing couples versus trying to isolate a woman. So he is at great risk to himself going in with the big threat of a male present. And some of these men had guns inside the house, guns in their nightstand drawer. And yet he's still willing to take that risk in order to commit these crimes.
What do you think triggered that evolution? I mean, I've seen theories that possibly that the media, when they pointed out that he never went into a house where there was a male home,
Yep. That
do you think that might have been what triggered him to then start doing that?
Yes. There was a newspaper article in the Sacramento Bee. I forget the exact date of that article. However, in one of its paragraphs, it says he never attacks when there's a man home. And then it wasn't the next attack. It was the attack after that is now he's attacking with a male present. And this is something with the East Area Rapist that was seen, is that he did respond to what was being read, what he was reading in the media, whether it be on TV or in the newspaper articles. And here he was, his manhood was being questioned, right? And he was like, okay, I'll show you I can do this. And I think internally, the offender had, this was something that satisfied him, you know, because once he starts doing it, he continues to do it. He doesn't just prove he can do it. It's something that he does over and over again. So it's something that I think met a fundamental need psychologically for this offender.
Okay. So he then shifts his MO. Now he's going in with a male at home. He threatens the men and he, like you said, stacks dishes on his back and says, you know, if I hear the dishes break, I'm going to kill your wife. And that becomes his MO for a while after that. And then where do we go from there?
Well, in mid-1979, up in the Bay Area, in my jurisdiction, Danville, he has a case that goes sideways on him. It's a couple that's asleep. He does his typical entry into the residence, but the male is a light sleeper. And the male kind of senses somebody's in the bedroom and opens his eyes and looks at the foot of the bed and sees this man standing there pulling a ski mask on. So this male gets up and just confronts him face to face. You know, what the F are you doing in my house? Get out of here, blah, blah, blah. And while the male is doing this, his wife gets up out of the bed and runs out. And now the East Area Rapist realizes, okay, I'm done here. He runs out. And that's the last Northern California case that we know of. 3 months later, he shows up down in Santa Barbara, though the original investigators didn't know this yet, but he does an identical East Area Rapist style attack where he, you know, gets the male bound with dishes on his back and the female separated. But while the female is laying there on the floor in the family room, the offender's pacing back and forth saying, I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill him this time. I'm going to kill him. And female victim hears this. She freaks out. She screams when he runs up and grabs her. The male hops out the backsliding door out of the master bedroom, and he bails. The offender bails. He actually gets chased by the neighbor, who is an off-duty FBI agent, but he's able to escape. So at this point, he's verbalizing that he is wanting to escalate to homicide. And then 2 months later, just a couple of blocks away from that kind of aborted attack, that's where we have the first double homicide attributed to the original Night Stalker. And that's Dr. Offerman and Dr. Manning. And they're killed. They're both shot. And it appears that Dr. Offerman had slipped his bindings and tried to get up out of the bed to make a run at the offender. And the offender shoots and kills Offerman and then goes over to a bound Deborah Manning and then shoots her in the top of the head and then runs off. So at this point now, the original Night Stalker has started his series. But Southern California authorities have no idea that this is a serial rapist out of Northern California.
Right. Yeah, no one's made that connection at that point.
No, not at all. Now, the original investigators out of Contra Costa heard about that first attack down in Santa Barbara. And they're saying, that sounds like our guy. That sounds like the East Area Rapist all the way down there. But when they reached out to Santa Barbara authorities, Santa Barbara's going, no, not same guy. And we're basically not going to cooperate with you. And so it really was at that point where the door was shut on the Northern California investigators. And the East Area Rapist investigation does eventually go cold up in Northern California. They're not realizing, oh, their guy is now down in Southern California killing people.
Right. Now, do you think there's another evolution there, right? So he evolves now from, you know, just women, then to women and men, and then he murders this couple.
Mm-hmm.
And you said like the case before that, they literally hear him talking about wanting to kill them.
Yeah,
like is that something you in a serial rapist that you see as like a kind of a standard or natural evolution for them, where they devolve or evolve, I guess, depending how you look at it. Or was there something you think that triggered that?
You know, it really is dependent upon the type of offender and the person. You know, very early on in the East Area Rapist case, Sacramento law enforcement did consult with some psychologists. And the psychologists were saying, this is a guy that's going to kill. You know, so they knew this was a serious offender. However, like, in fact, up on my wall, I've got some courtroom sketches. I just testified at this NorCal rapist, who's another serial rapist out in Northern California, large geographic span. But he is the type of rapist. NorCal rapist is the guy that would lay down next to the female victims and stroke their hair and whisper sweet nothings into their ear, basically trying to mimic a consensual relationship. He's your power reassurance type rapist. These guys rarely kill. And if they do, it's either to eliminate a witness or it's out of accident, but it's not something that they have an internal drive to do. Versus the East Area rapist is this power assertive slash anger retaliatory type of rapist. I mean, he is somebody that is violent. He was psychologically sadistic. And so he was showing that kind of that innate personality where he's likely going to continue to escalate his level of violence. But it's variable. But that is an evolution for some of these serial predators. You know, they start out with the trespassing, the peeping into windows. They start breaking into houses when nobody's home, like Visalia Ransacker. Then they take the next step and they break into houses when there's people present. They may not attack those people. These people are just sleeping in their bed. And you see these videos of these types of individuals that will be standing in a couple's room or a woman's room, you know, at the foot of the bed, just looking at her, possibly masturbating, and then leaving. That's a dangerous offender right there, because he has now crossed a barrier to where he is now inside a person's residence with the person present inside their room. That's the type of person that is more likely to go hands-on and resort to physical violence and possibly escalate to where now they're not only just going to do a sexual assault, but potentially take it up to homicide.
So once he makes that jump in escalation to where he now has committed his first homicide, where does he go from there? Does he come back down, or does he keep it at that level?
Well, that is an interesting kind of topic to discuss, because with the Golden State Killer, once he's down in Southern California and starts killing people, we're not aware of him committing any other crimes where he's leaving the victims alive. Mm-hmm. But with D'Angelo, you know, at the point that he is now in this original Night Stalker phase, he's already killed Claude Snelling. He killed Brian and Katie Maggiore up in Sacramento when he was probably being chased while they were out walking their dog and they saw him out prowling. And then the first homicide in Santa Barbara, the male gets up and tries to come after him around the bed. And all three cases are where he is kind of reacting defensively. The victims are not doing what he's expecting. And now it's self-preservation. But it's the next case in the original Night Stalker series in Ventura, March of 1980, 3 months after his first double homicide in Santa Barbara. Lyman and Charlene Smith are asleep in their bed, and the offender comes in and gets them bound in their room. And he sexually assaults Charlene, and then he bludgeons Lyman and Charlene while they're laying side by side in their master bed. This I've described as sort of the Golden State Killer's opus. This is a case, a homicide, that occurred from beginning to end the way he wanted it. He's not reacting defensively and shooting the people, the victims. He is bludgeoning this couple. And from this point on, all his homicides after that are bludgeoning homicides that he's doing because that's what he wants to do. That's what he likes to do.
So this goes on. He's now become a serial killer. And like you said, there's no, it's not every other or anything. At that point, every attack is a murder.
That's right.
And that's his plan. And then is it 1981? All of a sudden he just stops.
Yes. Yeah. So he gets into he goes into a house and he's back in Santa Barbara, you know, so he's, you know, to kind of go through, and it's just a brief series. We really only have six cases for the original Night Stalker, minus the one that goes sideways and he's chased by the FBI agent. Mm-hmm. So you have the double homicide in Santa Barbara in December of 79. Then you have Lyman and Charlene Smith being killed in Ventura in March of 1980. Then he goes all the way down south to Laguna Niguel in a gated community in an upper class neighborhood and kills, bludgeons Keith and Patrice Harrington to death in their bed. Then he's out in Irvine and he kills a single female, Manuela Whittoon. Her husband happened to be in a hospital. Then he's back in July of 1981, the case that you're talking about with Gregory Sanchez and Sherry Domingo. He's back up in the Santa Barbara area. And it's after that case where we don't have anything for 5 years. But it's so important to understand what happened in that case, because in that case, when he first breaks into their room, Gregory Sanchez is already out of the bed facing him. He ends up shooting Gregory through the face. Gregory gets a bullet through the left cheek that exits out behind his left ear. It's a non-fatal wound, but Greg drops down to the floor. Now, the offender goes and interacts with Sherry Domingo up on the bed. There's evidence showing that she had been bound, and it appears that Greg reanimates. He comes, he gets his wits about him, and the offender now is having to re-engage with 6'3" Gregory Sanchez. And there's evidence with blood patterns and the injuries to Greg showing that there is hand-to-hand combat going on between the offender and Greg. Mm-hmm. After this attack, the offender looks like he's rapidly leaving this residence. He's tossing bindings as he's running out of the house. Something spooked him, like maybe a patrol unit, rolled by or something. But I believe that the offender was scared. I think Sanchez scared him. And, BTK, Dennis Rader, had a similar experience where he goes inside a house and gets into a fight with a male that he wasn't expecting to be there. And Rader, mm-hmm. during his interview, says, yeah, you know what? I was done. I could have been killed. I could have been hurt. I could have been caught. I didn't want any of that to happen. I was done. So that's what I think is going through the Golden State Killer's mind after his interactions with Gregory Sanchez. But then 5 years later in Irvine, we have 19-year-old Janelle Cruz home alone, and she's bludgeoned to death in her bed.
And then that was his last known attack, right?
That's his last known attack. And, this is where, starting to correlate, the Golden State Killer now as being identified as Joseph DeAngelo. At the time of Janelle's homicide, DeAngelo's 41 years old. He's no spring chicken. And this is now getting into the kind of the older range of your serial predator. And this type of serial predator is a very physical type of predator. He's out prowling. He's hopping fences. He's now becoming, middle age. And I almost hate to say that considering I'm 52, but physically he must know that his skills are diminishing. His capabilities are diminishing. And so I'm thinking he's, going, I just can't continue to do this anymore. Doesn't mean his fantasies didn't continue to go, but I personally don't think he has anything else after Janelle Cruz. And if he does, it's maybe one or two.
Well, and there was that 5-year gap where he was scared. And that was, I don't know a terrible amount about, serial offenders and how they do it. But is it common? Do you see that often for them to stop on their own free will? Because a lot of times in cases I've studied, like where if it just stops, like, well, they must either they're dead, they're arrested, something happened that caused them to stop. The fact that he's that type of predator, obviously is still having those fantasies, but to go 5 years without acting on it, do it once and then just done. How common is that?
Well, yeah, I've seen series in which these offenders work in clusters. They, they'll have cases in clusters and then there'll be big breaks in between. And, some of this is going to be due to what's going on in their personal life. They have stressors going on. And so they go out and they're offending, as part of, the way that they compensate for these stressors that are going on. When we look at DeAngelo, DeAngelo's wife was 2 months pregnant with their first child at the time of the Sanchez Domingo case. So now, after that case, he now has a newborn baby in the house. Now, is that something that caused him to be occupied, caused him to mentally change, the thoughts about what he was doing? We don't know, but it is a significant event in anybody's life to have a child. And that's what our offender was dealing with after that case. And it turns out that at the time of Janelle Cruz's homicide, his wife was 2 months pregnant with their second child. So is the stress of the kid being going to be born and being entering his life, is that something that is causing him to go out to offend? And then once he has the kid, you know, he stops offending for 5 years, and now his wife's pregnant again. He has to go out and relieve that stress, and he runs across beautiful Janelle, and he just can't help himself. And then he has a second child, a second baby in the house, and now he can't offend. And he's 41 years old, and he's going, well, I just can't do this anymore. Don't know. You know, unfortunately, he has never given us any insight into his thought process at all.
Has he ever spoken with investigators or interviewers like law enforcement at all to share any insight? I know that he eventually pleads guilty, but has he ever shared anything about what he did and why?
Nothing at all. You know, after he was arrested, he was, of course, interviewed. He was interviewed for many, many hours. And all the various people that went in there, they're just literally monologuing because he wasn't responding to any of their questions.
But did you ever get a chance to interview him?
No. In fact, you know, the strategy, Ken Clark, who is a very experienced homicide investigator with Sac Sheriff's Office, he and I were the ones that authored the arrest warrant. And then once D'Angelo was taken in custody, we had developed a strategy where Ken was going to go in, and we're going to do it in the order of the East Area Rapist original Night Stalker cases. So Ken was going to handle interviewing D'Angelo on the Sacramento cases, and most notably the Maggiore double homicide, because that was what he was arrested for, you know, because it was, mm-hmm. you know, homicides don't have the statute of limitations. And then I was going to join Ken to continue the interview on the Central Valley and the East Bay cases, because those were my wheelhouse. You know, that's right. You know, in part because, you know, the East Bay was my jurisdiction, but I also really focused in on the Central Valley, the Modesto, Stockton, Davis cases that were sort of the tweener cases between Sacramento and the East Bay. Unfortunately, the way D'Angelo responded to Ken Clark's questioning during the Sacramento phase of the interview, where he's not responding, and then he basically asks for his wife. And the way he asks for his wife is, well, where's my wife? She's an attorney. And now it's, uh-oh, you know, has he invoked? You know, we have a Miranda issue, and so we're huddling, trying to figure this out. And, you know, there's, you know, a process that goes on there. And then he ends up kind of making a similar statement a little bit further in the interview. And we did not want him to invoke before investigators from Southern California who had homicides had an opportunity to talk to him. So because of that, that's where now the original strategy of me going in under the assumption that he would be, you know, at least interacting with us, that went out the window. You know, it was like, okay, we can't just continue to press him on the sexual assaults. We need to get an agency with homicide into that interview room. And so that's where Steve Rhodes from Ventura, who was on site, was able to go in with Ken Clark to try to talk to him about the Lyman and Charlene Smith case. And it was still the same. There was just no information coming out of D'Angelo.
There's nothing. Just stayed cold through the whole, from what I've seen in any of the documentaries or anything, it looks like he just was very cold. He, you know, in his hearings, they showed video of him climbing around his cell, and then he'd go out to the hearings in a wheelchair looking like you could barely even move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, D'Angelo is throughout his career as a serial predator. I mean, his number one priority was self-preservation. And once he was arrested and he's sitting alone in that interview room, I could see his wheels turning inside his head. And he is strategizing. You know, he's a tactician, you know, and he's sitting there trying to think, how am I going to either get out of this? And he very quickly realized, I'm not going to get out of this. And the next thing is how am I going to minimize what's going to happen to me moving forward? And that's where you start seeing this feeble old man and possibly even a mental health issue with the babbling he's doing. And, you know, I didn't hear this personally, but, you know, the Jerry that he's saying, you know, Jerry made me do it. Mm. You know, I personally heard him say, you know, he made me do it. I should have been stronger, but he made me do it. So it's sort of like, well, is he setting up a mental health defense? And then you see him right. being, you know, first court appearance, and he's being wheeled out in a wheelchair. And I was like, well, no, that's not D'Angelo. The guy's bombing down on his motorcycle 100 miles an hour on surface streets. The guy is right. very physically capable. This is a bunch of BS. And it was part of his strategy.
Yeah. So you made the original connection. You kind of directed that when they pieced the East Area Rapist cases and the original Night Stalker cases. And then years go by, and this is a cold case. Were you working on the case that entire time? Was it like a pet project on the back shelf or whenever you got a minute?
Yeah, no, you know, it's interesting because when the connection to Southern California was made, I literally just went into a support role, and I sent everything I had on the East Area Rapist case down to Larry Poole at Orange County Sheriff's Office. And it was like, okay, Larry, here's everything. You need anything from me, I'll be there for you. But I just thought in a matter of months, this case was going to be solved in 2001. I was busy. You know, not only did I have my primary job responsibilities as now a manager and supervisor within the sheriff's office running, you know, a fairly complex operation with forensic services and the criminalistics unit, I had many other cases I was working. And so I kind of just pushed away from East Area Rapist, and outside of, you know, a few tips that would come in here and there, I didn't do anything with it up until roughly around 2010, you know, almost a decade. And at this point, this is when I've promoted up to chief of forensics. I'm a division commander within the sheriff's office, and I'm writing memos and doing spreadsheets and going, attending, you know, high level executive meetings and all this stuff. And I'm bored out of my skull. And I'm looking at my file drawer in my office. I had always kept the East Area Rapist files with me. And I'm looking at it going, you know, that case still is not solved. And that's mm-hmm. when I reengaged. And that's when I was like, okay. And at this point, I had moved into very much an investigative type of role. And my department really didn't know I was doing these kinds of things. You know, this is where I say mm-hmm. I kind of go rogue. So I had done a fair amount of investigative work on other cases. And I was like, you know what? I need to start digging into this East Area Rapist case again. And that's what I did. I ended up developing a strategy and then started looking at it. We had maximized, so we thought, what we could do with the physical evidence and the DNA at that point in time. I was like, okay, I'm going to start tracking down people and start talking to people and seeing if I can't figure this thing out. Who is East Area Rapist?
So when do you come into contact with Michelle McNamara, who was the author of I'll Be Gone in the Dark, who was the citizen sleuth that had been obsessed with this case for years?
Yes. So Larry Poole, before he moved on from Orange County Sheriff's Office, he was at one of our task force meetings. And this is something that, you know, your listeners need to understand, because a lot of people believe that nobody was working on this case when Michelle got involved. And because Michelle got involved, now all of a sudden law enforcement decides to do something. That's couldn't be further from the truth. We had a group of people, a core group of investigators across the state who were convening and working diligently on this case. And Larry Poole had come into communication with Michelle. I think she must have reached out to him. And so he brought mm-hmm. he brought Michelle's name up to the task force, saying, hey, she wants to do an article for Los Angeles Magazine. Is the task force willing to have this article done? And we as a group said, yes, it's time that the public knew more about this case and we could use the public's help. So that at that point, we decided to cooperate with Michelle. I didn't know Michelle at all, you know, but she was, you know, for me, she was just going to be another journalist that was going to interview me about the case. And she ends up calling me several weeks later after that meeting. And, you know, I've told the story where I'm kind of standoffish. I'm more Joe Friday with her. You know, it's like,
right.
Yep. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. No, you know, she's asking me all sorts of questions, but it became very apparent that she She knew the case. And when I would kind of be vague about an answer, she would zing me and say, oh, no, you know, I know, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay, yeah, okay, you got me. That's true. You know, so that's how I first got to know Michelle. And it really, that relationship just strengthened over the course of the next 12 months, you know, where, you know, she was a journalist, a civilian on the outside, and I was doing my investigation. And then she started gaining my trust a little bit. And so I fed her bits of information. And then when her magazine article came out in Los Angeles Magazine, I was scared. I thought, oh no, she's going to burn me, you know, with some of the things that I told her in confidence, you know, it's going to be out there and I'm just going to get reamed by my agency. But she didn't, you know, she held her mud and she kept whatever I told her off the record in confidence out of that article. And that's really when I was like, okay, here's somebody I can trust. Mm-hmm. And a couple months after that article came out, she called me up and was like, Paul, I've been asked to do a book on the case. And what do you think about that? And what do you think that the task force would think about that? And I was like, I'm completely supportive. You know, we need to have a good book done. At that point, two of the original investigators, Larry Crompton and Richard Shelby, had each written books about the East Area mm-hmm. rapist. But, you know, they're law enforcement. These books were not polished. And it was like, Michelle was a writer. And I was like, I think this would be something that would be good. So I fully supported it and offered to give her a tour of crime scene locations and a sit down interview. And she came up to the Bay Area and we rode around, you know, she's recording the entire time we're talking. And it was really at that point that a friendship developed. And it was a professional friendship, but there was also a connection, you know, on a personal level. And we started chatting about, you know, our personal lives and stuff. And from that point on, I just kind of opened up to her with what I was really doing investigatively. And she, as she was writing her book, she ends up getting off into the investigative tangents. I mean, to the point where she's going, having to go to her publisher saying, I need more time, because she wasn't writing, she was investigating, and we were supporting each other, you know. And that's where I've said, you know, I was kind of a lone wolf. You know, I just kind of did my own thing. I never had a partner on this case. Well, she became my partner during that time.
Oh, nice. And then now through that process, I have to ask, did you ever meet her husband?
Yes. Yeah, I met her husband a couple of times. Patton Oswalt, of course, you know, very famous stand-up comedian and actor. I didn't know him, you know, much. You know, he was the voice of Ratatouille.
Right.
Right. Yeah. But it was one of those things where I think I first met him. They hosted the task force at a restaurant down in Santa Barbara after one of our meetings. And Michelle wanted to read a passage of a section out of her book to make sure that it was kind of, you know, we got the vibe. And you know, she had her ulterior motive. She was trying to get closer to some of the other investigators on the task force, you know, so by doing this, she was able to get, you know, like I'm introducing her to Gary Kitzman from Santa Barbara and stuff. So that was the first time I met Patton. And I will tell you, you know, Patton is the sweetest man. You know, that's the only way I can describe him. He is so, I mean, you see him up on stage and he's got this huge personality and he loves to engage with the audience and rip on people and all that. But in person, he's just a nice guy. It's just like, well, this is very different than what I was expecting.
Well, that's good to hear. Cause you know, I mean, this is a side note. We'll get back into the important stuff, but you know, I'm a big fan of his, both his acting and his comedy. And I've seen him on a few shows where he's interviewed about this case and he just, you know, where he was, you know, not in his character, but himself. And he seems like just a great guy that was very supportive of his wife, who, for those that don't realize this, Michelle McNamara passed away prior to the catching of Joseph D'Angelo.
Yeah, no, we had gone to CHIA in Las Vegas, California Homicide Investigators Association. So every year it's an annual meeting, big, huge meeting, you know, 800 plus attendees, homicide investigators from all over the state and even outside the state. And it's so big, it has to be held in part in Las Vegas. There's other reasons it's being held in Las Vegas. But through connections, Patton ends up becoming the kind of the entertainment for the Thursday night dinner. You know, he's doing a stand-up act and awesome. I mean, he had all of us just rolling. But during that time, I spent the week with Michelle. We would meet in the restaurant area downstairs. And then I ended up going up to their room in order to see some of the materials that she had access to that I had never seen in the case, including photos from some of the homicide cases in Southern California. And so now I'm just like, oh God, she's got stuff that might I could use to potentially help solve the case. And I just remember Patton coming in. He had tried to go downstairs to read a book. And because he's Patton, you know, he is just constantly right. being pestered. And he's just like, God, I just can't be alone, you know? Right. And that was my first realization of seeing a celebrity and their life in terms of, you know, they almost have to live in a shell, because if they do venture outside of that shell, they just can't do what they want to do. But that was, we spent that week together. And then it was about 6 weeks after that is when she passed away.
Right. And it was a tragedy. You never got to see the case come to fruition, but you were able to, with the help of a few other people, take the ball across the goal line. And you used some interesting technology and kind of the short version. I'll let you walk through it. But I mean, essentially you used ancestral DNA to narrow down who Joseph DeAngelo was. What was that process, kind of just a condensed version? How did you guys end up catching the Golden State Killer?
You know, I had started diving into genealogy and DNA all the way back before I met Michelle. It was back in 2012. And there's a genetic genealogist by the name of Colleen Fitzpatrick, and she's still very active today. And we were using an older genealogy technology based on YSTRs. The Y chromosome is what makes you a man, makes me a man. And it's the DNA is passed from generation to generation on the father's side. And the hope using this technology was to try to uncover the East Area Rapist Golden State Killer's surname, because, you know, just like the Y chromosome, you know, our surname is passed down on the male lineage. And that's what genealogists utilize. So I'd been doing genealogy. So I was already kind of keyed into the genealogy side. When I got called into a conference call on a completely unrelated case, it was a 2002 homicide in Contra Costa County. I had gone out on as a supervisor. Unsoon June had been bludgeoned and buried underneath her house. And then her live-in boyfriend, Larry Vanner, was arrested. And then he just almost immediately pleads guilty, which is very unusual for a homicide guy to plead guilty. And in investigating him, Larry Vanner wasn't his real identity. He was a mystery man. We didn't know who he was, even with everything after being arrested and even being convicted. Didn't know who he was. But through fingerprints, his criminal history had been linked together. And in 1986, he had been arrested for child abandonment down in Santa Cruz. And he had abandoned a six-year-old girl named Lisa Jensen. And he claimed that she was his daughter and that her mom had died in a traffic accident, I think, back in Texas. Well, now, you know, he's been arrested, you know, for this homicide in my county. And I was like, well, what about this Lisa Jensen? And one of my good buds, who was a homicide investigator on the Unsoon June homicide, Roxanne Grunheide, became absolutely attached in terms of, okay, who is this Lisa Jensen? Because we did some DNA and he's not her biological father. We believe she's been abducted by him from somewhere across the United States. But we, over since that time, had tried. Rox had tried. I was trying using traditional DNA and traditional law enforcement resources to identify this Lisa Jensen. Well, now in 2017, February 2017, I'm called to a conference call by Roxanne. And then Peter Headley from San Bernardino Sheriff's Office is on the line and he's going, I've identified Lisa Jensen. I was like, how'd you do that? And he had identified her as Dawn Bodin, a missing girl out of New Hampshire from all the way across the country. I was like, how did you do that? And he goes, well, I used a website called DNAadoption.com And I relied on a genealogist, Dr. Barbara Ray Venter. So I left that conference call going, I'm calling this Barbara. And I get back to my office and I call Barbara up and I say, hey, I'm working this case. I don't tell her what case I'm working. I say, it's a big deal case. With how you identified Lisa, would that work with an unknown offender? And she was like, I see no reason why it wouldn't. In fact, she was working on trying to identify Larry Vanner. And it was basically doing the same thing. Here's a guy, we know who he is. He's in custody. In fact, he died in prison, you know, before we had a chance to go back and interview him. But she ends up identifying him ultimately as Terry Rasmussen. And what the technique that she used to identify Lisa Jensen and Larry Vanner, respectively, as Don Bodin and Terry Rasmussen, is the technique that I was like, will this work for this Golden State Killer case? Though I don't tell her what it is. And so that was the first step in terms of utilizing this. And there's some things that happened with the investigation and the whole YSTR path I was going down. We ended up doing a search warrant up in Oregon, and that didn't work out in terms of it wasn't our guy or anybody. He wasn't closely related. But afterwards, I had an FBI. He's a lawyer with the FBI. He's general counsel out of FBI LA by the name of Steve Kramer. And we had just had our very last task force meeting on this series. And this is March of 2017. And the Steve Kramer calls me out of the blue. And I'd never met him. I'd heard his name prior. Mm-hmm. But I had never met him. And he says, I hear you are pursuing something about genealogy and DNA, because I had given the task force an update on it. And he goes, I believe in that. How can I help you? And I was like, oh, thank God. You know, I've got somebody interested, because I was kind of on my own at this point. I had another FBI agent that was helping me with some stuff. But then when the Oregon thing didn't work out, he kind of tapped out. And now I've got this other guy with federal authority. And I was an FBI task force officer at the time as well. I was like, oh, thank God. Yes, you can absolutely help me. And this is where I'm at. You know, I've talked to this Barbara Ray Venter, but she's not calling me back. But I think what she did in this case is the way we can solve this case. So Kramer and I just start self-educating ourselves on this genealogy tool and, you know, getting this, what we call a SNP profile, single nucleotide polymorphism profile, very different from what law enforcement utilizes for their forensic DNA testing. And it became, we have to do this. But the problem was that I had consumed all the DNA from the cases out of Contra Costa County doing the actual original testing as well as the YSTR testing. So now I had to reach out to Southern California agencies, and Steve was located down there. Reach out to them to see who would be willing to utilize some of their valuable homicide DNA evidence on this completely unproven tool. And fortunately, we went down. I did a roadshow. I went to multiple agencies and then ultimately was presenting to Ventura DA's office and their investigator, Steve Rhodes, and their biology unit supervisor. And kind of explained, this is how I think we can utilize your DNA evidence to solve this case. And Steve was like, oh, absolutely. You know, and he got his boss's signature. And that turned out to be absolutely fortuitous, because part of the problem at this point in time is that the genealogy testing labs required a huge amount of DNA, because they don't deal with forensic samples. They deal with, you know, 5 milliliters of saliva that you put in a tube that you send back in the genealogy kit, right?
Right.
Well, we're dealing with minuscule amounts of semen evidence. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, how are we going to get this profile generated? Because these labs don't have the technology to do that. Well, it turns out that the pathologist that did the autopsies back in 1980 on Lyman and Charlene Smith made it a routine to collect 2 sexual assault kits from the female. Well, one kit had been given to law enforcement, and over the decades, the DNA out of that kit had been consumed. You know, so it was like, is there enough remaining to do this new tool? While Steve Rhodes is marching down on working with his lab and looking back at the evidence, he realized, oh, there was a second sexual assault kit collected by that pathologist, and it's never left the coroner's office. So he goes and finds it there, and it's been untouched. It's still in its original sealed state. So no DNA had ever been consumed out of that kit. So that gets submitted to the Ventura lab. And the DNA analyst calls me up. And at this point, you know, I had said, I need a lot of DNA. And she says, I can give you a tube with 500 nanograms of DNA. Now, your listeners are not, most of them are not going to know what that means. That, for from a forensic sample, that is a huge amount of DNA. That is a gold mine of DNA. And I told that DNA analyst, I was like, I, in good conscience, cannot accept that much DNA. But what I do need is I need 210 nanograms. I need 200 nanograms to go to the genealogy testing lab. And then I need 10 nanograms to go to the Dr. Green at UC Santa Cruz, because we're going to attempt whole genome sequencing. And next thing I know, she was able to produce that tube. And Steve Kramer had a local agent grab that tube. And then that we got that going to the genealogy lab. So that was a huge thing to get that sexual assault kit and to get that much DNA. And at this point, we're forming a team. It's Kramer, myself, and then Steve Kramer had a crime analyst or an investigative assistant out of his office down there in Orange County named Melissa Parasot. And I was saying, I need somebody out of Sacramento, because I all along was a Golden State Killer, a Sacramento based, and I want somebody out of Sacramento who has access to law enforcement databases. And so I ended up, talking with the elected DA, Anne Marie Schubert, and she gave permission for Lieutenant Kirk Campbell and investigative assistant Monica Tchaikowski to be part of this. But because of some politics that I won't go into, we were doing this covertly. And nobody outside of this team knew what we were doing. And we got the original genealogy results. And I send them up to Sacramento saying, go, because this Monica is just awesome. Start working your magic. But we didn't know what we were doing. And Barbara, the genealogist, didn't communicate with me after that initial outreach. I thought she didn't want anything to do with law enforcement. Well, it turns out she had a major health issue. And so she just happened in November 2017, reached back out to me and said, hey, Paul, do you still need help on that case? And we were just now getting the DNA done. It was like, oh my God, yes. So Barbara ends up becoming the kind of the overseer and the teacher of the process. And so we get the initial DNA results with the potential, the individuals out there that share DNA with the Golden State Killer in January of 2018. And we start building trees, utilizing this genealogy tool that Barbara is directing us on. And we, are building trees for like 3 months. It's frustrating. We didn't have close relatives, so we were having to build extensive trees. And ultimately, we start seeing some males that fit the right age range, have the geographic connection to California, start popping up in the trees. And that's where I just kick into, it's what I call investigation 101. Is this the Golden State Killer? And how does this person add up with what I know about the Golden State Killer?
Right. And then so you have these family trees, you narrow down a few people, and then you're able to kind of by process of elimination land on, you think it's Joseph DeAngelo.
Right. And for me, I was really keying in on this guy who at the time was living in Colorado. And he matched what my theory of the Golden State Killer case was, because I thought the Golden State Killer was in the development construction field. And this guy was that. And I mean, here's this guy that we find, through Golden State Killer genealogy DNA. And he's got uncles that are living in the very neighborhood where the East Area Rapist first attacks. One uncle, I end up interviewing, two of his ex-wives, and he's a rapist. He tried to kill one of the ex-wives, so he's a bad guy. The other uncle happens to move down to Stockton the same month that we first had the first East Area Rapist Stockton attack. And then that uncle buys a house from the company that the second Stockton female victim worked for. And I was like, God, you know, it's just, there's enough churn there that I thought this was the guy. But then with testing of one of that guy's close relatives, who we've never identified, we're able to eliminate the Colorado guy. And for me, the last person was this Joseph DeAngelo, who was an Auburn cop. And I'm looking at him going, I'm just not buying it. I don't see how a full-time law enforcement officer all the way up in Auburn is committing all these attacks over Northern California from 1976 to 1979. But I was like, you know, I got to dig into him. And that's when I started. And I'm a week away from retirement, or 2 weeks away from retirement at this point. And so the time is clicking and I'm like, okay, well, I got to figure out this DeAngelo character. And that's when I'm, you know, I tracked down, you know, his former police chief that fired him when he got arrested for shoplifting a dog repellent and a hammer up in Citrus Heights in June of 79 or July of 79. You know, I reach out to Bonnie, his ex-fiance. She doesn't return my phone call. I didn't know she was actually out of the country at the time, you know, and then I'm up in Sacramento just researching him at that point.
And then as the story goes, as we wrap this up, they narrow down to him. A team goes and collects his DNA from what is it, the handle of his car. We get the match and he gets it's, you know, even knowing the story, just, you know, I just kind of reviewing things. I watched the recent 2020 episode that you were on again. And every time I see it, it's just such a, it almost gives you chills when after decades and decades and decades that all of a sudden, you know, what you must have felt when you get the call that, it's a match. We got him.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it, you know, that, I mean, obviously that phone call from Kirk Campbell, you know, I'm out in Colorado Springs buying a house and I'm eating at PF Chang's and I get a phone call and I'd been getting updates on the surveillance, you know, and I just thought that's what it was. And then Kirk, as soon as I answer the phone, instead of the typical, you know, salutation, hey, Paul, how you doing, whatever, it's like, you can't tell anybody. You know, he had gotten the DNA results back from the door handle from DeAngelo's car. Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, there's certain memories about, you know, the identification of DeAngelo that will be with me for forever. Yeah, they're just crystal clear. Because it is. It's such a momentous. You know, at that point, you know, I had been involved in the case for 24 years. You know, so to get, you know, to think about 24 years, and as we talked about, it wasn't like 24 years of constant work, but it was still 24 years of my life. In the last 10 years of my life, I was 24/7, 365 on the case. That, well, I was just obsessed. I was going to solve this thing.
Right. Yeah, that's it's an amazing end to a really intriguing and amazing story. And with that, Paul, we ran a lot longer than I promised you I would keep you for today. But I appreciate you coming on and taking the time and telling the story. It's been a real pleasure. And if people want to come check out your podcast, it is The Murder Squad.
Yep. Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad. It can be pretty much found, you know, on any place where you can download podcasts. You know, and I am in the process of trying to get a book about my career, which of course includes Golden State Killer case written. And, you know, hopefully that will be announced in the upcoming year.
Awesome. That'll be great. And thanks so much, Paul. Hope we'll talk to you again soon.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for listening and for your patience during this season. I know that you're all chomping at the bit for us to get back to our usual format. And believe me, I am too. Mike and I have decided that come hell or high water, we will be beginning a new case for season 10 on February 7th. So we're just about a month away. Now, in the meantime, this is our last episode of 2020. We're taking next week off for the holidays, so the follow-up for this episode will air on New Year's Day, our first episode of 2021. And after that, we'll have 5 more episodes of Season 9, and then we're going to get back to as close to normal as we can. Again, I thank all of you for your patience and for your support, and I hope that you all have a happy holiday season. Until next year, Cheers, my friends. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing and sound engineered by Shane Yoder. All music for the show is created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. All of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, and Jen Reese in Candela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes videos of the creation of our Friday follow-up episodes that always include 10 to 30 minutes of pre-show bonus chat. Other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. To become a patron, just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. And I personally can be found on social media at Bob Ruff Truth, and Mike can be found at Murb Gaming. MURRBGAMING. Don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.
Seen the film. You know the game. Now, Jumanji just got real. Only at Chessington World of Adventures. Featuring Daredevil Dad, Mom on a mission, and the kids who can't wait to ride the world's first Jumanji roller coaster. An epic adventure awaits. World of Jumanji. Only at Chessington World of Adventures. Book this summer's must-do day out at Chessington.com.